We're going to look at, for the third time, in Genesis chapter 16. We've been looking at the story of Sarah and Hagar and their relationship, and this is kind of the last run of this particular topic until we come several chapters later to the second time of conflict between Sarah and Hagar. But tonight we're going to kind of conclude chapter 16 and this part of the story of Abraham, and then move on it for now. I'm really kind of curious to what you think. I don't usually start my sermon and ask you what thoughts you have about the story so far, but this is the third out of three runs in Genesis chapter 16, and just wondering if you have any thoughts or observations or things that have been on your mind a little bit from our study. Anything that you would say, well, you know, I've been thinking about this. Maybe I've been talking to somebody about this, and it's on my mind. Anybody have anything that kind of sticks out to you that you want to comment on or for us to think about for a minute? Why in the world did God allow this to happen? Boy, this is a mystery. And there's a verse, not in this chapter, but in the next chapter between... What's that? Oh, yeah. If you live long enough, I'll tell you why. Don't expect anytime soon. Yeah, I tell you what, I circled a verse in chapter 21 and reading through Genesis that I absolutely find one of the most difficult verses in the whole Bible to understand. I cannot solve why it is, and I'm not going to go there tonight, but I actually underlined that verse, and I'm asking God to show me, because I don't know the answer to it. There's something in chapter 21 that just really perplexes me about why God has allowed something to happen. God allowed Islam to begin. I mean, you go back, God allowed Eve to eat the fruit, you know? That's the beginning of it. Why did God allow Eve to eat the fruit? Why did he allow the serpent to tempt Adam and Eve? Why did he allow Cain to have the strength to rise up and murder his brother? That's the problem of evil. That really is no different than the whole problem of evil that we struggle with. The only answer I can come up with the problem of evil, well, not the only, but the only one that's satisfying to me at all, is the issue of free will. And that really does govern our doctrine about a lot of things and what we believe about why God allows things to happen. God somehow has chosen to allow us to make the decision of good and evil. That just, it doesn't seem possible for an infinite, awesome, holy God. I don't quite understand that, but somehow it's found in the free will of God, in the free will that God allows for us. So, John, I have to say, too, that's pretty much on line with how I try to think about the problem of evil, which Hagar and Sarah is wrapped up in, as well as Adam and Eve and Noah and our lives today. Well, that's an interesting question. Why? Why did God allow Hagar to become the mother of what led to the... Yeah, and blessed Hagar. We're going to find tonight that God blessed Hagar. Blessed her now and in chapter 21. Yep, 2,200 years later, after Hagar, came Islam. So you're right. Yeah. Yep. But the tensions that took place immediately within two generations of Ishmael's birth and Isaac, the tensions begin back there. I mean, they begin between the people of God and the foul tribes and descendants of Ishmael who opposed the people of God and opposed Isaac's descendants, and all the way from the journey through the wilderness and through the eastern side of the Jordan River and the 40 years in the wilderness and the Moabites and the Ammonites and all that list of Jebusites and Perizzites and Rephanites and Girgashites, all those names that we talk about at the end of chapter 15, God knew what was going to happen, and yet he allowed it to happen. But you're right, the actual rise of Islam didn't take place for 2,200 years after this story, but certainly the descendants and the conflicts, though, the conflicts were continuous from that point. Thoughts and observations, and I really want us, when we study, to interact with the story and wrestle with what it means for us. I know I've said that many times. When I preach, I don't want to come to the end of the sermon and not have anything to say about what God would speak to me. I'd rather find something than say, okay, this is what it says to me and my heart. Yeah. I've always believed that God has a best for us. And when we fall short, God doesn't give up on us. He still has a best for us of how to deal with it. And the second best has usually a lot of consequences that are very unpleasant and painful. This story is all about consequences. But God always has the right thing for us to do, even after we've messed up and done wrong. There's always the right course to take. And kind of Hagar's story is a little bit about that. Yep. Certainly in the beginning part of the chapter, however we see it, apparently Sarah and then Abraham believed that God was not going to do what he said he was going to do, at least the way they thought he was going to, and they jumped ahead, and it was hard to trust that God was going to do what he promised to Abraham. And so they kind of took it by their own decisions. And how, I think that's what you're talking about, is I couldn't hear everything you said, but I think I heard the gist of it. Yep. They got ahead of God, and boy, did that create problems and issues for them. Yeah, several things about that. One is, you know, going to Egypt, was that what God wanted them to do? It doesn't say that they disobeyed and went to Egypt, but, you know, people wonder, did Abraham get ahead of God's will by going to Egypt? And then for that decision, it says that, and she had an Egyptian handmaiden. Yeah, a very pagan. Whether Hagar was or not, we really don't know, but that's the possibility in what we think of in that part of the story. We had him all figured out. He wouldn't be God and we wouldn't be man. Any other thoughts you just want to share? Again, I want our time to be relevant to where we struggle and we ask questions in life. Jewish theology is a little different than my theology. Jewish theology accepts humanity very easily and says, well, that's just the way it is. Whereas sometimes Christians, sometimes me, sometimes us in the Church of the Nazarene, and sometimes holiness doctrine type people, sanctification people, wrestle with accepting the humanity of people that we think are so great. I don't think Jewish theology has trouble doing that. They're more accepting of who these people were with their warts and all. They have no problem. You know, well, when I say no problem, they accept the failures very easily of their great people because they expect them to be human. They don't kind of have a vision that they're super people, but they were called of God and selected by God and used by God in the midst of that. And that's a good observation. I mean, Abraham, he's top notch next to Jesus in the world of religion. Abraham would probably be the one that's second most highly revered in the whole world. When you look at all the religions and of course, we've been focusing here for 3 weeks on chapter 16. It's not the only story of Abraham's life. There's so many good stories and that show why and how he demonstrated such great faith that pleased God. But yet, he was human. And even looking at the story from the best angle we can, we think, well, he should have done that different. But I know what you're saying there. Man after God's own heart. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's hard for us to, it's hard for us to wrestle with that. If he said that before he sinned, then, you know, he just made a mistake. God just made a mistake. But to say it afterwards, what does it say about the character of God and how he looks at forgiveness and redemption and remembering our past against us? I mean, wow. God is able to do what we cannot do with the ability to look beyond sin and look with redemption, but that's a good point. All right. I don't want to belabor this, but if it's enjoyable to talk about observations and just, I think that's a good thing for us to do sometimes. Well, let's read the rest of chapter 16, and then we'll jump in here. Chapter 16, let me begin here at verse 7. The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert,
There was the spring that is beside the road to Shur. And he said, Hagar, servant of Sarah, where have you come from and where are you going? I'm running away from my mistress Sarah, she answered. Then the angel of the Lord told her, go back to your mistress and submit to her. The angel added, I will so increase your descendants that they will be too numerous to count. The angel of the Lord also said to her, you are now with child and you will have a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard of your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all his brothers. She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. You are the God who sees me, for she said, I have now seen the one who sees me. That is why the well was called Beer Lahai Roy. It is still there between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son she had born. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. Once again, we return to this story. By this time, Abraham's 86 years old, Sarah is 76 years old, and it would still be 14 more years before God will begin to perform the miracle and basically bring about the promise that he promised to Abraham, and at least in the way that Abraham believed and the way that we believe God wanted him to do that. But the story within the story is the relationship between Sarah and Hagar. Last week we observed that when Hagar knew she was pregnant, the conflict began. Although the conflict maybe could have been before then, or maybe not. I mean, the circumstances of Sarah giving her handmaiden to Abraham and for him to sleep with her, maybe that happened immediately, maybe she conceived immediately. You really don't know that. We don't know for sure, but whatever happened there, there doesn't seem to be any recorded time between those events. And it's upon the knowledge that something had changed and that Hagar had conceived that seems to stir up the conflict and the problems that would later become deeper and deeper. It says very clearly here that it was when Hagar became pregnant that she began to despise Sarah. Somehow the attitude of Hagar changed when she became pregnant. Somehow something was going on in the context of the story and the relationship between these two, what could have been and you would think should have been and may have been a time of great joy for Hagar, and I guess for Sarah too, because she's the one that wanted this to happen and brought about the circumstances. Whatever, it was the knowledge of the conception that brought about the opposite reaction and began to stir up the animosity between Hagar and Sarah. And it began with Hagar here. It begins with her despising Sarah. It had never been an equal relationship. When you think about the handmaiden and you think about the matriarch and you think about the wife of Abraham, this man who was successful and wealthy and influential and had this unique and amazing relationship with God. I mean, you have Sarah in all these ways that are way up here, and then you have Hagar down here. She's a maidservant. Later on, Sarah would not call her a maidservant. Sarah would use a different word, a different Hebrew word, and say, that servant or that slave Hagar. And so it would become worse in the relationship later on. You think of that. Sarah had a husband. Sarah had security. She held a position of authority over Hagar. But Sarah did not have what she wished to have the most, and that is to have a child. On the other hand, there was Hagar. She was the servant. She didn't seem to be asked about this arrangement and what was going to happen. And so she began to feel resentment when she became pregnant. Perhaps, I mean, we don't know exactly what Hagar struggled with and why she despised Sarah. We kind of speculate and look at things later on that happened and parts of the story. It's possible that Hagar could have felt used. I mean, in the same way that if this type of thing could happen today and you know, the feeling of being made to do something that you didn't choose and sexuality and bearing a child for someone else who gets all the glory of it and wonder of it and kind of almost attributed to be her child after this happens. Maybe Hagar just had those simple human feelings of being used. It wasn't fair. It wasn't her choice. She could have felt that way, or it may have been a different feeling, but the conflict grows, and in verse 7, it got so bad and got so terrible that she fled from Sarah's presence. I mentioned last week or maybe a little bit 2 weeks ago, I mentioned it could be that Hagar felt like, well, now I deserve more. Now I deserve a position with Abraham. Now I should be elevated. I should be his wife. He's not called his wife right here. She is still seen as a foreign concubine. The position that she may have felt was unfair. Whatever she felt when she became pregnant, then the tensions began. And it wasn't, I notice here, Abraham that she seems to have the animosity toward. There is no animosity demonstrated in the book of Genesis between Hagar and Abraham, only between Hagar and Sarah. And so she fled from Sarah. She was running from her problems. Sometimes running from our problems seems to be the best solution, but it's really not the best solution. Sometimes, depending maybe on our personalities and the type of problems that we encounter in life, our first reaction, certainly some personalities, the first reaction is to run, to get away from. And we see in this story, in this part of Hagar's life, that was her reaction. She was running from her problems. She didn't know where she was going, but she wanted to get away. Sometimes it seems easier to run than it is to fix the problem or try to fix the problem. And there appears to be no other context other than the conflict started, the mistreatment started, and Hagar left. Now we also know from what the angel said to Hagar that apparently there was more to Hagar's attitude than we might give her credit for at this point, that there may have been more to the despising than just seems to be on the surface. But for now, we'll just leave it at that. She didn't know where she was going, but she left in a hurry and trying to flee from her problems. Even today, when we think about the context of this story and where it took place, this story is pretty amazing from a number of perspectives. Even today in this area in Israel, there is not much out there. Having the privilege of spending almost a week in southern Israel, I had the opportunity to drive the one main road that goes south from Hebron and then Beersheba and then all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba, which is a stretch of about 150 miles. As far as I know, there's about two towns in that stretch. And then there's oasis here and there where you're driving down this desolate road. You see no vehicles for the most part, but off to the left or the right, you might see a few trees, palm trees, and you see little huts, nothing big, no big major buildings, no three-story buildings, but just little tiny huts. And those are places where people live in the desert. And that was 2012. November of 2012. Imagine what it was like there 2,400 years ago. I had three or four pictures from my journey there, and I'm showing you pictures of the area that is right described here in this story, the road from Shur. I mean, this picture right here is one of the most beautiful places I've ever been on earth, but it's this bowl. It's called the Makdish, and I've already talked about it before, so I don't want to just give you the same stories over and over again. But this is what southern Israel looks like, except for the town of Beersheba, which is, you know, we have the description from Dan to Beersheba was Israel's territory at that time. Beersheba's all the way down here, and that was considered the end of the earth in the Old Testament. There was nothing beyond Beersheba. Now there was. It was this. And so we have some stories of this and people that fled into the wilderness. When Hagar walked out, wherever they were, which was somewhere south of Hebron, which is already desert, it's like this, except there's a town of Hebron, for the most part, a little bit of a spring there, and so they did water, and they had crops, and they had animals. But when Hagar leaves, she is going into something like this. I mean, it really is desolate, and it is today, and it was more so 2,400 years ago. I mean, today there's a road that's blacktop that goes all the way from from Beersheba all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. People drive it every day. I drove it, rented a car, and I drove that road. And there's basically no roads to the right and the left, the east and the west. There's just trails that cars and vehicles can go on. But it is desolate. And this is the area that we're talking about where Abraham lived. I mean, we want to think of Abraham as living in this beautiful palace and right along the Tigris River and all the amenities of fruits and vegetables and everything. That's not how Abraham existed. That was long before they were irrigated. Abraham probably lived along an oasis, along a spring. And there he had water for his animals and his family. But when Hagar left and fled from the presence of Abraham and Sarah, she was in trouble. She probably went on a journey. However far it was, we don't know. It says she was on the road to Shur. Now the road to Shur, Shur is the area that moves over from where I'm talking about, south of Jerusalem, and goes west into the Sinai Peninsula. And that is all desert. That is all wilderness. It's all wilderness today. But somewhere along there, that's where she fled from. And she was alone. And imagine the aloneness that Hagar must have felt. Now, how far she got and how what she took with her with provisions, I don't know. I can't imagine she could have gone that far on her own, but maybe she had enough provisions for a while. But it says in verse 7 that the angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert beside the road to Shur. Now, wherever the angel found Hagar, it wasn't a pleasant place. It had to be a very desolate and lonely place. It's my guess that Hagar made it to the first watering hole south of where the tents of Abraham and Sarah were. At this time, again, this is still early in Abraham's life in the Promised Land. He's 86 years old. He'll live another 94 years in the Promised Land, But Abraham is a nomad. Abraham spends most of his life as a nomad. And that road to Shur winds south from Hebron and west into the Sinai Peninsula, away from Beersheba, which is that last city to the south, where you really have trees and you have fields because you have a river in Beersheba. And then south of Beersheba, you just don't have hardly any water that looks like that. So all those pictures that I have tonight are very real for what Hagar would have been experiencing. Well, when you think of that southern part of Israel, it's called Negev or the desert, and it's salty and it's chalky and it's dry, it's lonely, it's desolate. And that's right where the angel found her. This last picture here will show here. This is along that road south of Beersheba down through the desert. The road is blacktop. It's a great road. But to the left and the right, there's nothing. And I stopped at this place on one side of the road for as far as the eye could see was white chalk. I mean, you go over and pick it up, it's like picking up pieces of chalk they use on a chalkboard. Tell you, if anybody needs chalk for your classroom, just go to Southern Israel. It's free. I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of square miles are just this big chalk field. So I went over, I picked up a piece of chalk, and I went across the road, and the ground was bare. And I wrote this message for you guys. That was from my trip in Israel. Again, you just can't imagine the desolation down there. It's not like anything I've ever... We have in America. I mean, we have trees. We have creeks. We have fields. We have animals. We have birds flying over. I mean, I just haven't lived like this. But it's amazing to see people live in the desert, and they're in those little shabby huts, sometimes made of canvas, along the road, and you think people live here. It's just hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine what you see when you're there, but that's how desolate it is. And this is 2000, of course, and 12 when I was there. But this story reminds me that no matter how far we go, no matter how far away we are from anything and anyone, no matter where we go emotionally, no matter where we go physically, God is always able to find us there. And that's kind of one of my takeaways from this surgery. The angel of the Lord found Hagar. The angel of the Lord knew where Hagar was. She was on a desolate road. She was near a spring. Maybe she was staying there because she knew, if I leave this spring, I'm done for. I'm not going to have water. I mean, what would you do? Traveling, probably walking. Maybe she had animals. Maybe Abraham, but it says she fled
as if she just got up and ran out and took off down the road, and not a lot of preparation. And just imagine if she found water, wherever she found water, she'd be pretty locked to. And the angel Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. Again, later in chapter 21, we read the second time that Hagar flees. And the circumstances, again, are very dire, this time with her 14-year-old son. But no matter where we go, God is able to find us. There's not a place, and you know, we think of a location in this story, but I'm talking much deeper than that. I'm talking about there's not a place you can go in your life where God doesn't know where you're at and care deeply about you. God can find you. God can find you in your circumstances. God can find you in your story. God can know right where you're at, and He has the right thing to say to you. He knows what to say to you wherever you're at. God is able to do that. I'm thinking of the psalmist, and where can I flee from your presence, O Lord? In Psalm chapter 139, if I go up to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in hell, there you are, the psalmist says. And understanding, again, David understanding how God knew where he was. As you mentioned earlier, God knew where David was in the depth of his miserable failure and sin. God knew where he was. God knew where David was in the glories of his life and all the victories. But the good and the bad, the high and the low, David says, oh God, you know where I am. And that's so true and found in this story. The angel of the Lord found Hagar. He knew where she was. There's no place, there's no circumstance, there's no problem where God cannot find us, where God does not know us, where God is not aware of our story and the hardship and the injustice in this case, in this story. The angel of the Lord knew all along what had happened to Hagar, knew that Hagar had been mistreated by Sarah. The angel of the Lord also knew Hagar's part of it, and though we kind of wrestle, which was it? Which way was it? Was it both, or was one more at fault? I mean, you know, we really don't know that, but the angel of the Lord knew. The angel of the Lord knew where to find Hagar in the midst of the situation. The angel found Hagar and asked two simple questions. Where have you come from and where are you going? Where have you come from and where are you going? You know, I think those seem like real just simple questions. At first I read right past when I look at the story, but then I've stopped and thought a little bit more about these questions. Where did you come from and where are you going? Hagar, you need to stop and think about this. You need to think more about where you came from. How'd this happen? What's going on inside of you, Hagar? What's your part of the story? Why is it that you have this conflict? Again, I've kind of always attributed most of the conflict to Sarah. That might not be fair. In fact, we hear the angel addressing Hagar about her part of it. But the question the angel asks is, Hagar, where'd you come from? What part in this do you have? And where are you going? Where are you going to go with this conflict? What are you going to do, Hagar? I mean, you think the answer is just to run out of the tent and say, I'm leaving, and storm out and leave Sarah behind and prove something, you know? I wonder how Hagar heard those questions, but they certainly seem to me to be questions that were asking something deeper than just the surface. Hagar, what are you doing? What's happening in this story? Are you sure being out here in the desert and alone is how you should deal with this conflict? I mean, Hagar, is this the right thing to do because you've been mistreated? Should you run like that from the problem? Should you flee from Sarah, your mistress? And, you know, the angel just seems to ask those two questions. And from that context, just trying to see what it is the angel's trying to say to Hagar. Sarah, where are you from and where are you going? Probably it's a good thing for us to ask some kind of questions when we have conflict, you know, and I've certainly had my share of it. But Wayne, when you're having conflict with somebody, maybe you need to step back and ask the question, where are you coming from? What are you running from? What is it that hurts so deeply? What is it that you're struggling with that you don't know what to do about? You don't know how to resolve. You feel hurt by. You feel like somebody's treated you unjustly. You know, this story, among other things, teaches us some things about conflict too. And these two questions of the angels are pretty good for us to confront and look at in our lives and times when we struggle with conflict. Because I think when God asks us those questions, it's different than when we ask each other, you know. When I ask you, you got a problem or you got a conflict, and I might talk to you about it as your friend, as your pastor, as a Christian, and I'm trying to help you to sort with it, you know, and usually the first thing we do is always justify our position when we have conflict. I mean, that's just natural. We all do that, you know. Every conflict I've had, I know I've been right about, you know. Anybody here not like that? If so, we'll make you into the first saint of Mifflinburg, you know. Honestly, I mean, get real here about conflict. When I have conflict, I justify myself and my position. And it's not fair and it's not right. And I think that's where Hagar was. So the angel asked two questions. Where are you coming from? And where are you going? Those are two questions to put in our heart and our mind when we have conflict. You know, the word of the Lord is deep and rich. And Timothy talks about how it's sharp. It's sharp. It's sharper than a two-edged sword, and it cuts through. That's the way the questions of God can be. If I ask you that question, that's a human question, but if God asks you that question, you come before God and you say, God, okay, I'm going to think about this question. What am I coming from? What am I running from? And where am I going? Where am I going with this bitterness? Where am I going with these feelings? Where am I going with this struggle and this animosity? Where am I going? Those are the questions that come to my mind when I hear those two questions the angel asks Hagar. Where are you going? Where are you going next? What are you going to do with it? Is your plan going to bring blessing? Is your plan going to bring healing? Is it going to bring strength? Is it going to bring faith? Or is it just going to kind of make one problem deeper and more bitter and more difficult and never able to be solved and resolved? I don't know exactly what was going through the mind of the angel, but I know what goes through my heart when I have conflict, and the words of the angel says something to me. Because the next words of the angel are very specific. I mean, the angel had to know more than I do, obviously, and we do, about Hagar, because the next words the angel speaks says, go back to Sarah. Wow. Now, this is God speaking. But what did God tell Sarah, or tell Hagar in this story? Go back to Sarah. I mean, as far as I know, Hagar didn't pour out her whole story. She probably figured the angel knew anyway, you know. The angel cut through something and just got right to the core of it. Hagar, go back to Sarah and submit to her. I kind of wrestle with this part of the story a little bit too. Do you? Go back to the one that mistreated you. That had to be hard for Hagar to hear, I would think. Go back to the one who has used you and who unfairly forced you to do something that wasn't your choice. Go back to your mistress. Wow. Go right back to the painful place. Go right back to that place where all those feelings are and the animosity and your feelings were and her reaction was, both your despising and her mistreatment. Go back there and submit to her. You know, maybe we would think here the angel knew more than we do. The angel was correcting Hagar and her attitude. And maybe the angel was shaping Hagar and saying to Hagar, Hagar, what are you running from and where are you going? But what you're doing is not going to work. You know, sometimes we don't know what will work when we have conflict. We really don't know what to do with our conflicts sometimes. Maybe Hagar felt that way. Well, I just got away. I ran away. But I know that's not the answer. Running from problems are not the answer. It may relieve some pressure for a time, but it doesn't fix problems. This is a tough one. I don't think anything really ever fixed this problem. God just worked through it with the people, like we commented on, and God allowed things to happen that we don't understand, but God was there, and we know that God was shaping Hagar, and we know that the angel found her where she was. We know that the angel had a message for her and a promise for her. We know that in this story, God didn't give up on Hagar. He's shaping her. It had to be a hard pill to swallow, but Hagar did go back. Again, there's not a lot of narrative here about Hagar arguing with the angel or saying, are you sure I have to do this? Or the angel giving more reasons, spelling it all out. It just, the angel said, Hagar, go back and submit to Sarah. What a message from the angel to give to Sarah. And I would say in conflict, if we get honest before God, there might be times when God would say something to us about our conflicts. And that might not be what we want to hear. Might not be what we think's the easiest to hear, but we'll always do the best if we respond to the nudge of God when he speaks to us in our conflicts and do what he calls us to do. Sometimes not the easy part or the easy answers. In this case, we know that Hagar responded, and God knew what Hagar was going to do. Obviously, he knew the next step. And so what does he do? He makes a great promise to Hagar. And the issues, I mean, we can't say of the story that, well, because she went back, Sarah, you know, fixed it all up and they were great. No, they apparently coexisted for 14 years from this point when she went back. I don't know how much conflict they had. We really don't have any indication of the conflict for 14 years. But at the end of 14 years, when Sarah got pregnant and had a son and they were rejoicing that God had done this incredible miracle, then the feeling started again between Sarah and Hagar, and then that story comes later. The issues with Sarah would flare up in 14 years, but for now, God told Hagar, for now, I want you to go back and submit to her. And so she went back, but she also went back with a great promise. Look at verse 10. It says, the angel added, first I want to look, the first three words of that verse is incredible. I love that. The angel added. The angel had just given the tough message. The angel had just given words that maybe Hagar, maybe she knew they were right anyway. Maybe she, hey, I can't live out in this desert. This is a dumb idea. But I don't want to have to go back and admit it. But whatever the case, the angel added. In other words, God said, Hagar, I know where you're at, but I'm going to tell you something else. I want you to know that I will so increase your descendants that they will be too numerous to count. And here's Hagar without a husband at this point. She's a servant. She's growing older too. She doesn't have a family, unless you consider Abraham and Sarah her family. And God makes a promise to her. In fact, he pretty much gives to Hagar the same promise that he gave to Abraham about his descendants. You remember what we looked at a while back and told Abraham to go outside and look up at the stars and see all that as numerous as the stars are, so your descendants will be. And I kind of felt in my heart, wow, you know. Well, it's the same promise to Hagar. God makes a promise to Abraham, and now he makes a promise to Hagar. The second part of the promise he doesn't make to Hagar about the land, but about the descendants, he does. Perhaps God was saying, Hagar, it's not fair what you're going through. Man's free will, and that came up a little bit ago. Man's free will has hurt you, but I will bless you. I will be with you. I will help you. Hagar, I know where you're at. I know what you went through. I know it's not been fair. I want you to go back, and I will be with you. So God did not leave Hagar alone. It wasn't an easy road that Hagar had to walk. Again, the free will of man. God allowed the free will of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar to interplay in this story. Hagar could not control the consequences any more than Abraham could, or Sarah could, but God did not forget her. The angel had a promise, and the angel had another promise in verse 11. You are now with child, and you will have a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard of your misery. The name Ishmael means God hears. And so God tells Hagar what to name his son, which is very special. You know, we have a handful of times in the Bible where God told the parents what to name the child. And those are always special.
And names were very, very important in the Old Testament, especially, and in Jesus' day. But God tells Hagar what to name the child. I want you to always remember that God hears. I mean, every time Hagar thought of her child and held her child and played with her child and watched her child, she would remember, God hears me. I wondered if that could be a blessing to Hagar later on in life when her son becomes that rebellious youth and he's wild as a donkey. The prophecy would say, if Hagar would still remember, God hears my misery. God hears where I'm at. God hears. And then in verse 12, we have the sad side of the prophecy. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all his brothers. All those things, God lets Hagar know ahead of time what's going to happen. And we've talked about that many times. Hostility toward his brother. But for Hagar, this was a day of trusting God. And this place, this spring, along the road to Shur, becomes a place of, you might call it a place of worship for Hagar. Hagar had seen God in this oasis in the desert. And she speaks these words of thanksgiving to God. She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. You are the God who sees me, for she says, I have now seen the one who sees me. That is why the place was called Beer Lahai Roy. It is still there between Kadesh and Bered. I wish I knew more Hebrew. I've heard that there's a lot of neat nuances of this Hebrew name, but I really don't know what they are other than I've read a little bit about them. But this was a place for Hagar of putting down a firm foundation of knowing that God was real. Yes, I've seen God, and God's seen me, even in my misery. In my misery, God has seen me. And Hagar worships the Lord. As far as we know, Hagar honors God. I don't know of anything that we know about Hagar that doesn't tell us that she will respond to God later on in chapter 21. She cries out to God, and God hears her prayer. But Hagar does become the mother of many people. She's revered by many. One last thing tonight. Verse 16 says, so Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son he had born. That tells me, too, that when she got back, she went back, she was accepted. If she would not have been, we wouldn't probably have verse 15 where Abram gave the name Ishmael to the boy. Apparently, when he went back, maybe things weren't quite as bad as she thought. That's possible. You know, sometimes in conflict, things just get worse and worse the longer we run from problems. But when she went back, apparently Abram apparently took her right back into the household. And although we don't know about her and Sarah, we do know about Abram. And Abraham took her. And when the son was born, Abram gave him the name Ishmael. Obviously, Hagar had told Abram all about it. Abram, God met me and told me that his name is to be, he hears me weeping. And so Abram gives him the name Ishmael. And so ends this part of the story.